with, if you can find the information without any trouble, I'll go up and take a look. Computer's upstairs, so I can't talk and look on the computer at the same time. Back to net, W2JPW. Thank you.
WB2HWW.
Yeah, good.
Dick, there's a lot of equipment available, a lot of the paging companies. You can find tons of equipment for Motorola paging amplifiers. You had the company up in Canada. I have a mental block right now. But there is, believe it or not, Dick, a lot of blinking done on 900. You can get conventional, Maxtrax or GM300s. There's a lot of equipment available that you can just software program up. A lot of stuff in the 902 to 27 band. And there are a lot of repeaters. There are several repeaters on the air. You'd be surprised. And there's a lot of activity on the West Coast also. More 900 activity than there's 1.2 activity. And the band is great for linking. And I wouldn't be surprised if Limewalk has some 900 stuff for some of their backbone communications. K2RIW, WD2HWW. I'm going to be clear, Dick. If you have any questions on 902, all you got to do is go to the MetroCore database and you'll see what's operating.
Good information. And let's see, now it was Lou who asked for Mott's call letters and whatever. The guy who's got the conversion article is Kilo Delta 5, Foxtrot Zulu X-ray. Kilo Delta 5, Foxtrot Zulu X-ray. His name is Mats, M-A-T-S, Bengston, B-E-N-G-T-S-S-O-N. And trying to remember where his website is, but that information alone, you just Google Kilo Delta 5 Foxtrot Zulu X-ray, you will find his conversion article, Lou. And as I said, it's nicely illustrated. It'll show you what the amplifier looks like before and after conversion. And as I said, the conversion is essentially just remove half the hardware that's there, all the linearizing hardware, and what you're left with is a very nice working thing. Okay, I think, let's see now, I believe we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in, who had a question for us. Before I turn it over to Paul, WS2N, Paul, I want to tell people that if you're interested in space at all, you definitely want to get a hold of the December 2007 issue of Scientific American. December 2007. I've had it in the house now for half a week. And I think it's the lead article. Yes, the lead article is on, entitled Window on the Extreme Universe. They're talking about the spacecraft that's going to be launched next spring, which is called GLAST, Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope. In other words, we're about to see what the gamma ray sky looks like with very high resolution and very high sensitivity for the first time. We've had a couple of satellites up there that have seen the gamma ray. And by the way, what are we talking about here? When it comes to astronomy, in theory, you can use millimeter wave, you can use far infrared, near infrared, optical, ultraviolet, and X-ray astronomy. And what's beyond X-ray? Gamma rays. These are the extremely high-intensity waves that come from either the creation of a black hole or the coalition of two binary black holes or the coalition of two binary neutron stars. And when these events occur, and somewhere in the universe an event like that seems to occur roughly once every month, you get a blast of energy, which is called a gamma ray burst. And to say it is loud is an extreme understatement. A gamma ray burst has an amount of energy that is approximately equal to 10 billion stars, a whole galaxy, every one of the stars going supernova simultaneously. That's the amount of energy we're talking about. That's a blast. That's a potent signal. So they're going to put up this rather high resolution, rather high sensitivity satellite next spring. And so, nice explanation of GLAST, G-L-A-S-T, is in that article. So, if you have an interest in space, and the article explains the fact that we are now living in very exciting times. In other words, we're about to open up this new door, so to speak, of a new portion of the spectrum where the universe has been talking to us for a long time and we haven't been listening. And it's going to tell us a whole lot of brand new information. It's going to give us a lot of new theories as to how we got here and what else is here with us. So thought I'd bring that to your attention, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, that sounds good, Dick. It's glad. All right, we'll take a look at that one. And December, Scientific American. I haven't seen it, but I will keep my eyes out for that. Sounds good, Dick. Okay, well, what's new in the space world? The Harmony module has been reconfigured and set up for future docking of the Columbus module to be sent up to the International Space Station December 6th. They did another spacewalk yesterday. They completed it. They went outside and hooked up different cooling lines and different connections that have to be made, and actually bypassed that unit. One of the connections supplies power from the International Space Station to the space shuttle when it docked. They had that working last time, but the module was in the way, and after they installed it, you had the space shuttle hooked up directly to the Destiny lab, and they had these connections that were made to power the space shuttle for the last couple of flights. They took up power from the space station solar rays, but when they put the Harmony module on there, now they have to extend those lines past the Harmony module to the docking port for when the space shuttle comes back up again. Space shuttle used to dock to the Destiny module, now it's going to be docked to the Harmony module. And they're going to also attach the Columbus module built by the European Space Station to the Harmony module in December. So I hope that all goes well. They have it loaded into the space shuttle, ready to go. It's 23-foot long, 15 diameter thing. There's room. Start waiting, I could tell you. Tremendous amount of I can get the tonnage, 30,000 pounds or more, I think. So that should be an interesting flight. It's going to have big scientific racks inside this thing where it could fit up to like 6 or 8 refrigerated sized racks for experimental modules that will be going in there. When you send the shuttle up in the future, you'll be able to bring up experiments on these racks, fly them into the racks of the Columbus module, and they'll stay there for as long as it's required, and they'll be able to return them on future flights. They just did similar things with the space lab in the back of the space shuttle for years. They had a big lab set up in the back of every one of these space shuttles that have had it, and you had all kinds of room to work back there. They did that for many years. Now, those things were also built, those rooms, those modules were built by the European Space Agency. So they had some experience with this. The only difference is this is a permanent one. The past ones used to go up to the space shuttle and they would return. This one here is going to be attached to the space station there. It's going to sit for the next 10-year lifespan, if not more. I thought that was pretty good. Last week you asked about the rovers, how they were doing. All I did was check on the internet, and they're doing very good. The Opportunity is running along inside that Endurance crater. It actually got inside now, near the top, and I expect that thing to be in there for the next 6 months to a year. NASA has given an extended mission financing for the two rovers for the fifth time. So here we are, coming up to the fourth year of riding around on Mars. Spirit, that one is not faring so well right now. It's got quite a bit of dust on the solar panels, more than it's ever had in the last couple of winters on Mars. It's already spent two winters on Mars. And it's coming up to a third one in a couple of, three, 4 months from now. So their goal is to get to this one little hill that they see in the distance, and try to go up this little mountain and try to get to the peak in time for the winter. This way they can tilt their solar panels more directly to the sun once they get over that hill, and hopefully it will survive another winter. And maybe they'll get another little windstorm, and once in a while that does happen, and that has cleared off the panels in the past on both rovers. So we'll see how that works out. So I thought I'd mention that. And I've been reading it up on the moon, possible moon landing 2020. Hope to establish a base. I think I mentioned that on last week, that South Pole Shackleton crater. Potential spot for the first lunar base. I mean, it's right on the South Pole, so because of the way the moon is tilted, you get almost permanent light there, you know, 80% light. Or if you go into an equatorial region, you're going to get a couple of weeks of light, a couple of weeks of darkness. So they think it's a better location to put a manned moon base on way on the South Pole tip. For a number of reasons, too, you have at the rim of the crater, you have almost permanent light. But yet, in the shadow of the crater, you have complete darkness. And you can use that for infrared telescope activity. You can set one of those things up there because it'll always stay very, very cold, never be in a light and shadow. Also, they think that you might have water, in the ground of the crater that they can mine and maybe utilize that for either drinking water or developing fuel out of it or what have you. So, and they're thinking seriously about this. They've got this module that they built and they're sending down to Antarctica. I think this month they're going to leave it down there for about a year and a half or a little longer. Maybe 13 months, I think I read. 13 months. And they want to see how this thing holds up. It's an inflatable module. It's 350 square feet, 8-foot ceiling, you know. So they could bring this up compact on a spacecraft, land it, and four astronauts could set this thing up in about 4 hours, they said. So that should be nice if they develop a system like that. Put a couple of hams in there and make some radio contact. They do have a high mountain on the South Pole near the Shackleton crater. It's 5 kilometers high, and they'd be able to set up a permanent transmission antenna at that location to have permanent contact with Earth. And I think that would be very interesting. Could you put a big beam up there for 2 meters or something? There. Back over to you, K2RIW, WSUN.
Hi, thank you, Paul. Good stuff. And lots going on in space. And more to come. Ain't seen nothing yet. There's also on the drawing board a number of very large telescopes that they want to put in space. In other words, Hubble, arguably the most successful telescope ever put up, is not as big as they want to go. They want to go quite a bit bigger. And I know that's going to eventually take place. Also, I'm of the opinion that Hubble is going to be repaired. You may have said, and maybe while I was doing this research for this file I was looking for, I may have missed it, but is there any new news, Paul, with reference to Hubble repair? Is there a preparation going on for a possible Hubble repair mission, to your knowledge, Are we still getting close to the point of deciding to abandon the darn thing? And I hope we don't. I'm a humble hugger. WS2N, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, they have 7 astronauts training for that mission, Dick. That's coming up in August of 08. STS-125. If you Google STS-125, you'll get the crew and what they plan to do and how many, I think a half a dozen spacewalks. You know, it's a big deal when they go up to that Hubble, as you remember, to work on it. So yeah, that's a go, Dick. We'll save that for another half a dozen years, hopefully, back here.
Okay, now, I guess I sort of missed it. I know that the decision to repair or not to repair was a bit iffy. Did I miss the fact that a hard decision was made? And the fact that it is an assignment, Space Transport System Number 125, STS-125. It sounds to me like a hard decision was made. No turning back. We are going to repair Hubble. Is that essentially true? And how long ago was that hard decision, if that's what it was? How long ago was that made, Paul? Go ahead.
I have trouble with time, but QSL, yeah, that's a hard decision. You'll see it. STS-125. You guys are training, ready to go. That was made by Michael Griffin, I guess, 4 months ago, I would think, something like that.
Okay, well done. I'm going to stop worrying about Hubble. Live horse until you get water. The cavalry is on the way. Okay. Mel, has some interesting mail arrived this week? And what's the latest in your neck of the woods in Manhattan Beach? K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay. Good evening again. This is KCKEY. Well, I'll tell you something. What I did, something interesting myself this week, being that Thursday was a very nice day. The weather was great, so I really wasn't needed in the kitchen, to tell you the truth. I guess people figured better off without me, so that they wouldn't get poisoned or something. No, really. So, all right, so anyhow, I decided to see what the heck I could do. One experiment that's been bothering me for a long time. You know, we've had this for weeks and weeks and weeks. Questions about 40-meter antennas being at 40 meters and 80 meters seems to be the stand of choice right now at the bottom of this propagation cycle that we're going through. We've been sitting at zero for quite a while. And so HF propagation has been very iffy. Bands like 20 meters and above are completely, I should say, not even above 20 meters. Just some activity, some, you know, openings during the daytime, but as soon as it gets dark, that's it. There's nothing much going on 15 or even on 10. I was on 10 today. Next, we keep this net, Sunday net going on 10 meters so that we can show that there is activity on 10 meters before somebody gets ideas they don't want it no more and, you know, make claims on it. So anyhow, one thing I've done about 40 meters I've used, I think I mentioned this dipole. It's a 40-meter dipole that's strung between a support of 66 feet and they go straight down within a foot or so of the ground with a 66-degree angle to the ground. So I decided, you know, to try some experiment with this. What happens if I go to a vertical, completely vertical with this antenna, or if I pull it and start moving it horizontal? Okay, I say the weather was great. I decide I'm going to do an experiment. First thing, I set up the receiver and put the pan scope on the receiver, basic pan spectrum display, move the tape down so I have a nice narrow, somewhat narrow skirt so that I could look at the this particular signal. And the station that was on was a station operating HK0, a number of guys that have went down to the tank at San Andreas Island off the coast of Columbia, to do to CQ work WAZ contest that ran this weekend on CW. So they were running a pile up on Thursday, just getting themselves, I guess, ready to do the contest on the weekend. So I figured I was looking at that signal, great signal coming in 599, and about 2,000 miles or so south. So I figured this is a great place, you know, to sit right now on this frequency and be able to observe different antenna situations. So this is what I did now. I'm going to go into the results. It's very interesting. First, any questions? Over. Okay, no questions. So here's what I did. I have one of my supports that holds up the AC in the loop. They're all on pulleys, rope pulleys, so it's easy enough to lower one end of it. And I put on there a pulley, pulled it back up with a fish cord. Fish cord is basically easy. That's a light cord, very light cord, fairly strong. And I put one end of the fish cord from the shack over the pulley and back down to the dipole. At the bottom of the dipole, I disconnected it. I put a lead weight. So now, without any pull on the dipole plumbs itself to become perfectly vertical with the earth. It leads straight down. I then watched listened to the signal on 40 meters. Gradually began to pull the dipole from its plumb point to approximately 66 degrees back to its original position. Did not see any change in signal at all, except at the plumb point, I noticed that the noise floor was higher. It just seems like the bass noise was coming up. The only thing I can account for that is basically because this is a street that ends here at the ocean, so there's not many, much traffic. However, now, 300 feet or so to my north is the main street, a lot of buses and trucks and cars, constant traffic that way. So I think that that's what I started picking up. Be more sensitive in the vertical position to that. As I move the dipole slowly back up, I probably pulled the dipole up to a horizontal position. And in the horizontal position, I noticed that the signal was not, well, you know, I observed, I watched the signal because I have to say that I did repeat this experiment up and down a number of times and came to the conclusion that in the horizontal position, the dipole being 66 feet at one end, down to 45 feet at the other end, that the signal, I'll be conservative, but say somewhere around a difference of 3 or 4 dB weaker in the horizontal position. Quieter than the vertical position for sure, and a little weaker than in the in that position signal-wise. I'm watching the scope, really not the SD, but, you know, just watching the piece on the scope there. I turned up big gain on the brightness on the scope, so I had a little bit more persistence and I was able to look at it, you know, more critical. So, what I did is, I could say up and down, for an hour and a half this was, went on up and down with the antenna. And I'll tell you something, I took all the information finally, and I went to the computer. All right, first let me see if anybody's got any questions on this.
Sounds like a fascinating experiment. And when you come back, one of the things I'm going to be asking, Mel, is that, yes, you got more noise when it was vertical, and you got less signal when it was horizontal. Do you believe in the vertical mode was the signal-to-noise ratio better on relatively long-distance stations, if that's what you were listening to? Back to you, Mel.
No, the conclusion that this is KEY. My conclusion on that is there was no difference in the signal strength whatsoever that I can see between the antenna, the dipole being plumb vertical or moved off to approximately somewhat of a sloper, making approximately a 66 degree angle with the earth, except it was less. I can see the noise floor it began to drop off. You could see it. Actually, I actually waved the antenna, moved the antenna back and forth. It was amazing. I could see that noise floor go up and down. Whether or not because I was picking up, you know, some particular noise and maybe just, you know, moving the antenna would just, you know, some way notch that, I don't know, but it definitely was a difference. So I went to the computer with all this information, and here's what happened. According to the computer feeding this information, that in the vertical angle of radiation plot, that in the vertical position, I should be putting out most of my energy very close to the horizon in the pure vertical position and should be looking at it between 10 and 12 degrees of elevation. That's what I should be seeing. On the other hand, if I had it in the dipole in the horizontal position, I should be looking at a maximum load of radiation somewhere between 30 degrees above the horizon in the horizontal, in other words, when I pulled it up. So, according to this, you know, if you want to take this as gospel, that the dipole should be good for short distances in the pulled up in the horizontal position and better in the plumb vertical position, dropping it. Oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you something. This is very difficult to say, but in real life, let's go back to real life, you know, it's pretty, you know, difficult to really draw a conclusion with you know, using the computer. Because let's face it, in the real world that we live in, we have things to consider that the computer doesn't take into consideration. And that is that the, you know, the earth below me is lumpy, bumpy, God knows what's in it. You got street lights, you got electric wires, you got the telephone wires and other, you know, objects, all kinds of things. So, yeah, the measurements here in suburbia, as they say, I think become a little unglued when you, you know, use the computer as your gospel. But I'll say one thing. If you can devise a better antenna that is as simple as this dipole, and mount it up like I have approximately a half wavelength in the air, and if you can come up with a simpler antenna that works, again, the word simple, antenna that can work, that outplays this type of dipole, I'd like to hear about it. So you can save your money by spending a lot of money on these, all these antennas and hundreds of dollars, and does hang up that dipole, and for a few dollars worth of material, a few, even very little worth of material, I mean, just some wire and a few insulators, I don't think you're going to do better than this sort of sloping down from 66 feet to approximately 66 feet of angle with the earth, and it works phenomenal, as far as I'm concerned. So unless you're looking to put up a tower or a beam and all that goody all the way up there, I think this is the poor man's or the simple way of going to go.
Now, one big variable, Mel, would be, were you listening to a man in Pennsylvania, or were you listening to a DX station when you did these experiments, or were you flipping back and forth between all of the above? The status of the ionosphere, the time of day, and whether you're listening to a long-range station or a short-range station, I think will make the data look different. Am I wrong on that one? Go ahead.
Yeah, I tried all that experiment, of course. I first was listening to the station at HK0, and went up and down, and I said, well, he's 2,000 miles and all, and then I listened to a couple other stations. One in Texas. He was also working a pile up on there because it does have a very potent signal. He's got a, one of these, quite an array, to say the least, this guy in Texas. He's got a stacked 40-meter beam on a rotating tower, plus a few others. I don't know how many rotated got on one tower, but I understand about somebody said about six. And so his signal also. So he in Texas, would be a little close, of course. And I was basically wiggling this antenna up and down, pulling it up and pulling it down, moving this way and that way and everything, trying to get something to say, oh boy, this is the answer to the situation. But it basically came down to the quietest of the operation, definitely was horizontal, pure horizontal, was quiet. But the signal report at the 66-degree sloped angle was very good, excellent signal report, as good as it is vertical, but also somewhat quiet. In other words, the quiet is a noise ratio, the signal-to-noise ratio is best when the dipole's in the horizontal position, all pulled up there at 66 feet to 45 feet. However, signal strength-wise, it definitely shows that there's no difference between pure vertical and slanting is somewhat thick, but the slanting of it did remove some of that, I would think, of course, local man-made noise, Dick, over.
Do you have the ability, Mel, with your fraction of a wavelength loop inside the house, can it also tune to 40 meters? And a comparison there would be quite a bit of fun, too. Back to you, Mel.
Well, I've done that experiment, of course, that's on 80 meters, 75 I do that, and of course that's what I use on 75 for receiving, because sometimes the noise on 75 meters is horrific at night. It used to be impossible sometimes to get a signal that was wasn't 20 over 9, you could make contact on 75 meters. So with the receiving loop, the dual receiving loop I have, what I do is, of course, I've got the noise washer. I have the two signals, the two loops, there's a loop inside the loop, so by putting them through that noise washer and that PM, that whole business, the whole three things I have built in a little box that I added on, I can, of course, focus and everything, you can get results for receiving. Point that wants to put the rest, really, of this business. That we're putting together, a lot of these questions that we've been having for the last few weeks about elevated feed line, elevated feed points on antennas and it's a beautiful piece of pipe to give you, the number of these antennas on a marketing, a nice piece of pipe, with this elevated feed and all these ideas. But the point is to spend all that kind of money, will it give you, phenomenal results? And I don't think you're going to get better results with that any of those antennas than you will with this vertical dipole stick. Remember, the feed point of this vertical dipole is always at least 33 feet above ground, over.
Yep. I'm looking forward to eventually doing one of those experiments similar to what Matt Barry into Moonbounce is doing, where he's got a what looks like an inverted V, but it's set on its side, and he's got that hanging off the side of his tower on 80 meters, and I'd sort of like to do one of those also. I'm not quite sure how many directions I'm going to do it in, but I've suddenly gotten a lot of faith in a vertical dipole. I have the real estate to do it. He has the real estate to do it. And 80 is a nice band to do this experiment on. I only have, I do have 120 watts on the base station rig, and I own a Heathkit SD200. Which I guess is capable of something like 800 watts of output, if I remember correctly. I think it's 1200 watts of input, and I don't know what the peak envelope power of output is, but I own a half-gallon afterburner, I guess is what I would call it, of Heathkit. I've been running for some time. I better check the the electrolytic capacitors, because I'm sure by now they're drying out, and the diodes, I think, keep checking and so on. But I'm trying to remember, when was the last time I was on 80 meters? Quite a number of years ago. I have done it from this QTH. I had a nice inverted V dipole on the tower, but that needs repair. But I have the impression that it's not easy for you to tune your inside the house loop on 40 meters. I know you can tune it on 80. I don't think it's got the ability to be flipped over for 40. If you wanted 40 meters with a loop inside the house where you could steer it as L and polarization, would you make a switchable arrangement on your current 80-meter loop, Mel, or would you build a brand-new 40-meter loop? If you were doing that, how would you go about it? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Very good. This is K2KEY. Well, I'm sure you could build one for 40. No, it doesn't work on it. I tried it. It will not tune at all on 40 meters. The way the, you know, the theory, the way the, one of these type of loops work, if, you know, take into consideration the number, you know, you've got distributed capacitance, and it also has to be the constraint to stay between less than 0.1 wavelength, you know, a number of different factors. So, but it's easier to make another one. You know, it's not there. That's a, you know, that's a complicated project. All you're doing is taking a frame, a wood frame, and then stretching a piece of coax around the outside, putting it at one corner, and sticking a variable condenser at the bottom of it. And sure, if you sit down with the information, you know, the formula ratio, the formula and everything like that, you can figure out what size, you know, would be necessary for 40, or build one for 20, or whatever you being then you wanted. There's no doubt that you can do that. The only thing I could say, I wanted to put to rest once and for all the situation there of really with the dipole. Does it have any effect going from vertical to slight slope? Does it have any, you know, what's the effect of going to pulling it up in a horizontal position? You know, things like that. And I found that it works excellent, because I do. I get terrific reports, everybody I hear on the 40BW that I call, you know, they come back to me, no problem whatsoever, great signal report. So I may not be the first one in on some of these rare stations that, you know, these DX stations come in there, but I guarantee you within the first few calls, I'll, you know, first few times, I'll get in there. As far as that amplifier you have, yeah, well, take a variac on it, Dick, bring it up slow, you know, initially, bring it up, let's see, slow, and there's a good chance that most likely you wouldn't have any problems working it, as long as you don't, you know, put it on initially without cooking it up slowly for a while. K2RIW, this is K2RIW.
Yeah, that's an attractive thing to do, and I own a variac that I could do that with. So you're saying slowly reform those tantalum capacitors that have had no high voltage on them for a dog's age. And it literally is a dog's age if they had no high voltage on them. Haven't turned it on in some time. And I've talked to people who left one of those SD200 sitting on the shelf for quite a few years and suddenly turned it on. And at first it acted pretty strange. Or they would blow out some of the diodes because of what the capacitors were doing in the process of being reformed. Now, I guess I wasn't aware, Mel, that you had the ability to mount a 40-meter dipole, which is 66 feet long, fully vertical. In other words, you've got a support structure on your property that is more than 66 feet in the air, so that that dipole, without shrinking it, would not have the bottom of it touching the ground. On the bottom of it, and from the top of it, pure vertical, is 66 feet long. So, I guess I thought that most of your supports were 45 feet high. I didn't realize you had one that went to 66 feet. Back to you on that one, Mel.
Roger. I have in the front of the house that I have a pine tree that's 70 feet tall. Tallest tree in the neighborhood. 70 feet tall pine tree. And I got a pulley from one of the branches all the way up there. at the 66-foot level. So the antenna, and you know, it's funny, the antenna is really in front of the house. But unless you look for it, you know, you don't see it fire. So, you know, if you have that kind of support, like I say, if the person's eye is not trained for an antenna, you'd walk right by it, you know, normally a person, and wouldn't even see it because it's actually in my front garden, Dick, over.
Well done. That microphone push-to-talk switch occasionally gives you a little bit of grief. Would you say you have the tallest tree on Dover Street in Manhattan Beach, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, this is the tallest pine tree in the whole neighborhood, believe it or not. It's a big one that's been there for I came here, and the tree was here. I have that removed, chop it down. And I said, no, that's a beautiful pine tree. And, I pictured it always as something with antennas, of course. The supports for the loop are separate supports. Not using this tree at all. I had used another tree up front that I used for one of the supports and for the full wave loop. And then I have poles. The others are regular poles. I have two poles in the backyard at each end of the yard that are 45 feet. Those crank up these poles. They have a carriage rides up and down. A very clever thing that I was able to purchase. They use them actually. If you ever see the gate that they have that says swinging, the gate goes up, raises straight up with has a pulley on it, and it pulls the gate straight up on a track. I wonder if you ever seen that, Dick, over.
I don't think I have. That sounds interesting. But now, the 70-foot-high pine tree that has a pulley at the 66-foot level. There's a bunch of questions here, Mel. Either you put that pulley in that tree when the tree was shorter, and now the tree has been growing and the pulley has been getting further off the ground. I'm a little bit skeptical of that. Or else you or somebody you appointed had a climb to the 66-foot level of a 70-foot tree, which means you're 4 feet from the top of a pine tree installing a pulley. Boy, I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. Go ahead.
Oh, boy, you got to ask that question. I climbed it. I'm getting a grumbling from the XYL here. She says, you weren't home. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I climbed up that tree. It's very sturdy to climb a pine tree, believe it or not. Those branches are very, they're like stairs. Pine tree grows straight. That's why they were very desirable for the old sailing vessels. That's what the mast was made out of, a pine tree, out of pine, because the strength of a pine tree is phenomenal. And the branches of it actually are steps. You can actually, inside the core of that tree, you can actually walk that up like a ladder, Dick, over.
Fantastic. Sounds like a nice, safe tree. I was up one of my oak trees a few years ago, untangling a guy wire that I was installing, and with a safety harness wrapped around the trunk of the tree, I was at the 70-foot level at some dark time at night, untangling this guy wire from a branch, and I said to myself, is this a reasonable thing for a person of my age to be doing it? And I guess I came to the conclusion the jury is still out on that one. No. What we don't do for the dedication of our particular hobbies. Yeah, we take a little bit of risk, but all of life is a risk. And we're not going to get out of this one alive, as you know. And we have these interests. We want to pursue them. And within reason, a certain amount of this has to be accepted. What a sane person does when he's doing a risky maneuver, he evaluates the risk-to-benefit ratio. He does whatever's required to minimize the risk. Maybe he does some checking with his friend. Is this the right way to do it? Maybe he has some friends standing by while he's doing it. Whenever I climb my tower, I make sure, for instance, that not only am I wearing a double harness, a chest harness and a waist harness, And so there's two separate lanyards going around the tower when I strap myself into the work position where I'm doing some work at a particular level. But I make sure that there's also a handy talkie strapped to my chest, held in such a way that it can't fall. The battery is held on with tape so the battery can't disconnect itself. And there's a similar radio on the dining room table in the house with the wife listening to that one. And the one that's with me, I could always dial it to another frequency where I've got multiple ways I can ask for assistance if I want somebody to connect something to the rope so I can haul it up. Whenever you're up a tall tower, you don't want to climb back down to get a tool. You want to have somebody attach the tool to the end of the rope and you want to haul the rope up. It takes a lot less horsepower to do that. Yeah, in my younger days, I would run up 100 feet of tower in 30 seconds. Those days are long gone. I climb 25 feet and stop and pant and climb another 30 feet and stop and pant and so on. That's the way climbing has to be done. But you have to plan ahead of time. I've also checked with my local fire department whether or not they've done what's called high angle rescue for tower situations like mine, where again, if I hired Holland Mayday, would they be able to get me back down? And the answer seems to be yes. They have practiced that exact maneuver. Okay. Sounds like a fun experiment. I wonder, from your point of view, is the vertical 40-meter dipole a somewhat completed experiment, or are you still gathering data on that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Now, back to its position. Took the lead weight off the bottom, tied it off, kept the pulley down, put the end of it back on to one corner of the loop, and that's that. I'm not going to go any further because I don't think there's pace to go any further. I think it's proven itself. Well, I'll tell you, I feel it's easier to find that pine tree than it's the tower because you can sit down and get up there. You can sit on a branch, one of those branches. You can sit down and actually relax, really. It's a nice, you've got a nice view up there from the tree. And I feel more secure because, the way the branches are, you've got to slip literally between the branches. So if you want it to fall, when you're in that tree up there, you'd have a problem. You wouldn't be able to fall far because the branches, it's sort of zigzag and everything, so the harness and everything. You'd have to really want to do a dive to get out of that if you want to, really fall. I feel, like I say, much more secure on the climbing a pine tree than I do a radio tower. Amazing. Strength of that those type of tree. Let's see. All right. I think that sort of covered that. Like I say, again, the simplest antenna, the dipole, I think is the bottom line is you can't beat it. You cannot beat it. And you can, like I say, put it up simply. It's an easy thing to camouflage if you put it up, in a place where you have a little bit of a problem with antennas that maybe, bring attention and give you some static from XYLs, and or other people. You put this up, it's invisible basically, mostly, and I don't think the bottom line is you're going to be able to beat it for and spend a few hundred dollars for one of these antennas that mock me, and it's going to be better than this dipole, this vertical dipole thing. Over.
KC2KKX, question on the pine tree.
KC2KKX, start off with your name and ask your question, sir.
Name is Peter, and if you remember, I'm still flying upside down from a couple of summers ago. But with all these branches in the way, or steps as you call them, how did you vary the angle on the vertical dipole? Just a question.
You got it, Mel.
Hey, Mel, I better tell you the whole story then. The dipole is not actually hanging, the pulley is not actually hanging from a branch. It's actually a piece of pipe that I've got up there that I strapped to the center of the tree, or the stalk of the tree, and it's got a curve on it because there's a buoy up there. It's got a curve, so it's curved out enough to make it so that I could then drop the antenna vertically. In other words, so I can actually get somewhat of the weight from the tree. Of course, also the tree has been trimmed properly, so it doesn't hit the house. It had to be trimmed, and also some of the branches had to be trimmed down to the bottom, so you don't, you know, cover the lawn with it. You can walk on the lawn, you know, cut the grass on the lawn and things like that. So the tree has been sort of pruned properly. This way, it makes it so that and pull the antenna, especially in the slope position. In the vertical position, yeah, it may touch a couple of the lower branches that stick out, but Texas position is pretty clear. But it's definitely in the slight slope position where it makes a 66-degree angle with ground. It's actually away from the tree from that point, Dick, over.
Question WS to Anthem now.
Go ahead, Paul.
Now, how far is this pipe sticking out from the center of the tree? What's the diameter of the pipe? And what's the pipe made of? And how do you have it lashed to the tree? Curious about that. Back to you now.
Okay. Well, it's a little bit of a magic, okay, how I did this. I took a piece of conduit, a piece of 3/4-inch conduit, you know, the outside, the aluminum conduit, I guess they call it. And I bent it, made a, used a bending bar, my bar, and I bent it into a sort of a big curve so that I could hang the pulley on the end of it. It's now to hang it in the tree, when I pulled it up with me, to hang it in the tree, what I did is I make a bracket up that's on this aluminum thing. It's a little bit of a strange-looking thing. I took a piece of, I think it was half-inch thick plexiglass, and I made like a U out of that piece of plexiglass, sort of cut it like a U. So part of it is held to the pipe with clamps, with hose clamps, and then the U part of it that just sits on one of the branches so it can't slide down. And then I scrapped it because, you know, a tree is going to grow and everything like that. I have to keep it in place further up. I just put the tie, heavy tie, but this pull them really tight, just enough to keep the pipe, you know, to support the pipe so it couldn't come away from the tree. That's basically how it's held. And I used that black polished cord that they sell, that black pipe. But I used that tree, pulled the end of the pipe pole up.
Mel, that push-to-talk switch is giving you some grief.
Yeah, I, no matter how tight I hold it, it seems like you got to squeeze it so my finger turns the color. But did you get most of that?
Yes, we did. And I bet your Pete's got a nice tall pine tree in his yard, and he's trying to figure out how to use it. Is that true, Pete?
Yeah, but I think I'm going to wait for April 1st.
And I meant Paul also. Paul, do you have a nice high pine tree in your yard that you'd like to use?
No, I just cut down a pine tree, but I got a couple of dozen oak trees like you, Dick. They're not fun to climb, though. I know what Mel's talking about. It'd be a lot better with them. But, no, that's a great idea. And so I assume this was about a 10-foot, you said a conduit, so they're usually about 10-foot section. Is that right, Mel?
Yeah, length, I think it's 8 foot. I don't know. You know, regular electrical EMT pipe, Paul.
Okay, very good. I still have some of that stuff laying around, too. Very good idea. Excellent. And how do you feed the dipole? Is this thing fed from the middle, or you have, you know, you're calling it a dipole, but so you got coax going up halfway up the tree, 30 feet up now?
Oh, no. The coax is hanged out there. It's a regular dipole cut with the plastic halfway formula. And no Dalum or anything like that. I just got one of these stuff. I got it as a ham set. They sell this cute thing this guy was marketing. It's a black T-like unit. And it's got an eye on each side of this little black T thing. And you take it apart, it's got a whole bunch of 632 screws. You open this thing up and you have some holes and things. And inside you solder your coax to the both of the eyes. And then you close the thing back up and it squeezes the coax. It's got a thing there to lock the coax by the, you know, by the, when the coax comes in so it can't pull out, pull the connection through.
Yeah.
You put it all together with the 632. And then you tighten the quarter 20 nut on each side of the eye. There's quarter 20s inside and all. So that tightens the whole thing up. And that's what I got hanging. It just hangs the coax is actually supported to the eaves of the house, so it makes like a loop, makes a big loop down, you know, to the to that point, so it's flexible. Everything can move because, you know, if you pull things tight, you're going to lose with the windstorms and everything. Everything's got to move nice and loose because, you know, that dipole will lose in a fight with that tree starts to pitch in a high wind, so nothing is pulled tight, and the most basic way of putting an antenna together, I don't think you can get anything simpler than this. If anybody's got something simpler that will work as well, I'd love to hear about it. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, now that sounds great. Very well done. So when you look up, if you're looking for it, you'll see the pipe sticking out of it somewhere, probably not near the top of the tree, probably about, what, three-quarters of the way up or two-thirds of the way up?
Yeah, within a few feet of the top, yeah. Just it thins out quite a bit at this point, the top of the tree. I want to, tie anything at that point. So that's why I said 6 feet is enough. You know, I don't have to go any higher at this point, so that's where it's sitting right now.
Very good. If anybody ever says anything, it's Christmas lights. I'm getting ready for my Christmas lights. Wow, that's a great idea. Dick, over to you.
That pine tree out in front of his house is his Hanukkah bush, and he's putting decorations in it. When you connect the bottom of the dipole at a 60-degree angle to the ground, which means, I guess, you're walking out from the base of the tree 30 feet or so, I presume you connect it there with some kind of a springy device so the tree is capable of swaying if it wants to, Mel. Is that true?
No, it's just stake down. I drove a stake in the ground, a piece of PVC pipe, a three-quarter-inch piece of white PVC pipe. I drilled a hole in it, and I put a hook on it. And, this was all a temporary thing when I did it. I wanted to see what happened. I was just curious, basically, and wanted something for 40 years. And so that's how I came up with it. And the dipole, look, it goes up 66 feet on the thing, on it, but it's got a lot of play in it. It's not, like you would draw a line from that point straight up. You know, it's got a bubble, some of a bow in it, Dick, not much, but you can see there's a little bit of a bow in it. If you take, the bottom off, you put a lead weight on the bottom of it and let it hang, it'll hang, perfectly straight, plumb straight. But I picked this 66 degree because it pulls it away somewhat from the tree. And then all these things I've looked at, it seems to be not only works to excellent, but it seems to be also the quietest position for some reason in this carryover.
KC2 KKX.
Go ahead, Pete.
I'm just approaching my home in Larchmont, Westchester, and just wanted to say I enjoyed the Tech Tech tonight. Listened to it all the way from Princeton, New Jersey, and particularly enjoyed the last 30 minutes. Good evening, KC2, KKX Clear.
Yeah, it looks like you hit pay dirt with that particular subject, Mel. One of the things I want to bring to people's attention is that University of Tennessee Amateur Radio Club, UTARC, University of Tennessee Amateur Radio Club. If you go to that website, utarc.org, you will find that they are launching a balloon this coming week and it's called the Transatlantic Balloon Program. So they're going to be launching a balloon from Tennessee by way of automatic positioning ham radio,